I'm a member of the Puget Sound Water Quality Authority, so I've had a fairly long-term involvement with Puget Sound. My title tonight was Puget Sound, Pollution, Better or Worse? And I can safely say that there are many unanswered questions about Puget Sound, but one thing you can say about it is, yes, the pollution is better and the pollution is worse. Both. I'd like to first discuss a little bit about Puget Sound, since a couple of you are from not around here, and talk a little bit about the oceanography. Any scientists here? Anybody to keep me honest? Talk a little bit about the oceanography of Puget Sound, and then I'm going to show some slides after a couple of transparencies. There's some discussion as to what the limits of Puget Sound are. If you talk to an oceanographer, the oceanographer will tell you that Puget Sound stops right here at Admiralty Inlet. If you look at the law, however, in Washington state law, Puget Sound extends to Cape Flattery and to the Canadian border. So essentially, it's all the inland waters of Washington state from Cape Flattery east. Puget Sound is really deep. The deepest point is over 800 feet. And let me just put up a pattern that shows circulation patterns or a cross-section of Puget Sound that shows the depth. And you can see in the main basin, which is really right off downtown Seattle, it's about its deepest point, very close to 900 feet in a couple of canyons. But in general, the main basin is up to 800 feet deep. As you head north toward Admiralty Inlet, it gets much shallower, comes up to about 400 feet of the surface, and likewise as you head south, it gets much shallower. Well, this creates some interesting circulation patterns in Puget Sound that affect pollution and all other man or human-related activities relative to the sound. With each tide, cold, salty water comes in from the ocean, open ocean. It mixes at the sill at Admiralty Inlet. And since it's more dense and colder, it tends to move south in the sound at depth. From the rivers and streams, fresh, warmer water then moves out. So the circulation pattern is that the cold water moves in at depth, and the warmer, less salty water moves out on the surface. With each cycle of the tide, less than a third of the water of Puget Sound turns over. So a lot of people compare it to a big bathtub that's overfilled. And as you shake the bathtub, some water sloshes out over the sill at each cycle. But a lot of the water just remains within the sound from cycle to cycle. If any of you have ever been to the Seattle Science Center, they have a nifty model of Puget Sound. And sometimes they'll put dye in the model to simulate an outfall or a discharge into the sound or a river into the sound, and then you can watch it through the tidal cycles. Likewise, the University of Washington has a model that they let people play with. Western Europeans began to settle the Puget Sound region in the 1850s. Let me just flip on the slide projector here. And found quite a bounty when they arrived in the Puget Sound region. Giant salmon, king salmon, particularly at the Elwha River, a run that's now totally extinct because of a couple of dams on the river. But lots of salmon in Puget Sound, and really a bounty. They also found giant logs in Puget Sound. And just like the American natives, Native Americans who were already there, they found these resources ready to harvest. And of course, about 140 years ago was when the California Gold Rush occurred. So a lot of the bounty from Puget Sound started heading south toward California. And as a matter of fact, many of the streets in Seattle and Tacoma are paved, many of the old streets are paved with blocks that came back as ballast in those ships from San Francisco, even today. Seattle and Tacoma also played a similar role in the Alaska Gold Rush. And by then, both of them had pretty heavy industry on their banks. Seattle had a lead smelter, Tacoma had a lead smelter. There was shipbuilding, lots of sawmills, and both cities by the 1890s had rail links to the east. Scandinavian immigrants settling along the shores of the Sound played a major role in developing commercial fisheries. The first fish cannery in the Puget Sound region was at Mukilteo in 1877. Boeing was founded in 1916. They celebrated their 75th anniversary this year. And the 1920s brought the first pulp and paper mills to Puget Sound, of which there are nine in the Puget Sound region today, most right on the shores of the Sound. The 1940s and 50s brought aluminum smelters and the first oil refineries. And the Alaska pipeline of the 1970s, of course, brought great expansion of those oil refineries. In addition, people showed up. And I'll show you a slide of the population development of Puget Sound a little bit later on. Of course, in addition to being a major industry, Puget Sound serves as a major source of recreation. This happens to be a fishing pier in Tacoma. And of course, there's a lot of boating on the Sound as well. People in the Puget Sound region own more boats per capita than anywhere else in the country. Along with development, particularly in the late 1970s and early 1980s, we began to see signs like this posted around the banks of the Sound. This happens to be in my hometown of Tacoma, but I could come up with signs like this from a variety of other counties as well. This one is backward, but it says, warning, consumption of fish and crabs from these waters, not recommended. This is the Port of Tacoma with its heavy industry, paper plant, right on the front of the front edge of the waterfront. These domes are major domes that cover aluminum ore that's coming in from Jamaica and the Far East and transferred to a smelter that you can see at the stack back here, which is a Kaiser aluminum smelter that was founded in 1947. That's your first thought when you think of pollution and Puget Sound, is heavy industry and point source discharges, or effluent from the companies coming out of pipes. In addition, you probably think of municipal wastewater treatment plants, or the place where our sewage goes. Well, that's only a part of the issues related to the pollution in Puget Sound. Some of it's historic, like the Asarco smelter, also in Tacoma, which is closed today and was the subject of a talk I gave about a week and a half ago here now. The Asarco smelter, as I mentioned earlier, was founded in 1888. It was a copper smelter from 1905 until 1985 when it closed. Downtown Seattle, along the waterfront, are a variety of discharges called combined sewer overflows, where the municipal wastewater from our homes and businesses gets mixed up with stormwater, and under normal conditions it goes to a wastewater treatment plant. During rainstorms, the pipes can't handle it all, so it comes out in various pipes that act as overflows, including one very close to Pier 59 and several others along the waterfront in Tacoma, in Seattle. Tacoma has no CSOs, combined sewer overflows. Olympia has a number of them, as do 14 other cities around the Sound. Scrappers. This happens to be a metal scrapper that sends scrap to the Far East. Notice that it's right on the banks of the waterfront, and metals, both dissolved and in particle form, wash off into the waterway. Sometimes things just come out back doors. Sometimes small companies discharge either unintentionally or illegally. When it came to this place, it now happens to be closed. The owners disappeared. Sometimes people dump stuff. This happens to be some stuff dumped by a guy named Buffalo Don Murray, who was later shot by his wife, but not over what he dumped over another woman.
The unfortunate part of it was, is that he's not around to tell people where he dumped all the stuff he dumped. Tank farms, such as this one, that have single-walled tanks and tend to leak into the ground under the tank. The fire department has reported that the water off this tank farm, just offshore because of seeps, sometimes has a high enough level of gasoline that they're concerned about it catching fire. This tank farm is now has a cleanup plan proposed, and the cleanup is now underway. Shipbuilding, something that was very prevalent in the Puget Sound region in the 1970s and took a big dive as shipbuilding went abroad, but there are still a few small shipyards. Oystering in Puget Sound from 1981 to 1991, we've lost 16,000 acres of commercial oyster bed to contamination by bacteria. 13 different oystering regions have been closed by bacterial contamination. Fortunately, in the state of Washington, we have a good program so that the oysters we buy, or any shellfish we buy in the stores, are good, safe shellfish. But the flip side of it is many oyster growers are no longer in business. Poor forest practices. Wetlands that are lost through filling and development. This happens to be a freshwater wetland. There are also saltwater wetlands like the Nisqually Delta at the mouth of the Nisqually River. And you can see a little bit of diking here. Once upon a time, this delta actually had even more farm, but it was purchased by the federal government to become a wildlife refuge and is now one of our most significant wetlands in the Puget Sound region because it's basically preserved for the long term. It has some threats to it, however, from development on the highlands on either side of it. Pressure from Weyerhaeuser to the north and pressure from Burlington Northern developing to the south. 28% of this wetland, that's really a pretty pristine river delta, is lost. But that compares to the river delta of the Puyallup River in Tacoma, which once had, this is the Puyallup River, which once had more wetland acreage than the Nisqually in the previous slide. And you can see there isn't a whole heck of a lot of wetland left. There's one very small wetland that's been built right here by the Port of Tacoma after they illegally filled a small amount of wetland that existed right here. They spent about $2.2 million building the wetland and another $4 or $5 million hauling off the wastes that were at that wetland because it had previously been a garbage dump and wasn't suitable for anything else. We're seeing increased levels of various metals and other pollutants in the sediments in the bottom of Puget Sound, particularly in the shallow, nearshore areas like the inner waterfront that you saw in Tacoma. And I'm going to come back and talk about that a little bit more later on. But you can see what has happened to lead. And this is done by taking a core sample and then aging the core, where the bottom is the oldest and the top, close to the water, is the newest. You can see how lead has built up, particularly after the introduction of leaded gas in the automobile in the 1920s and 30s. The 1990 data will be down just a little bit from this. And I have the 1990 data now. And of course, it's down because we use less lead in gasoline today. Dredging of these sediments, like in the previous slide, tend to mix those metals or other pollutants into the water. And this is an example of dredging that was going on in the Port of Seattle a while back. There are standards in Puget Sound now that very tightly regulate what you can dredge and where those dredge spoils can go. Runoff from streets and failing septic tanks. This happens to be in the Skyway area of Seattle. I was out here with the then King County Health Director Notice the lush grass that runs across this lot. It's lush for a reason. They basically had a failure of the septic tank at this house. They were at the bottom of a hill, and their drain field had completely failed, and they just dug a ditch out here to the street. And bacterial count in the water in the, along the street, a couple hundred feet away from the house, several hundred feet away from the house, far exceeded health standards. It's another example from that very same neighborhood where a developer had known that there were septic tank problems, so he'd solved it when he platted a whole area by essentially connecting all the outfalls or all the outlets from the houses to a single pipe and then running it off down the hill rather than to anybody's septic tank. And this happened in the early 1960s, and it took quite a few years before it totally failed, but one day the street started to cave in. Pesticides and other toxic chemicals that homeowners tend to buy. This happened to be what I found when I cleaned out my grandfather's garage. These come from my collection of slides of outfalls. This happens to be a storm sewer in Tacoma, which actually comes, the water that comes out of it comes out fairly clean. Although I was down there one day and during a storm event and saw a lawn, part of a lawn chair come out that outfall. There are two drains in Tacoma called the Twin 96s. Anybody ever heard of them? They're 96 inches in diameter. They're at the head of the city waterway, and they drain a good share of the area of Tacoma that's heavily industrialized, including the area around Parker Paint Company and the Nally Pickle Company. And in the past, there have been some fairly significant pickle discharges, fairly easy to track back upstream, as well as like paint discharges. Another concern in Puget Sound is the thin skin on the surface of the sound, or the microlayer. This just happens to be a shot of some eggs, but a lot of eggs and larval stages of animals live right at that air-water interface very early in their life. And if you take a quart of water, skimmed off that thin interface in the urban areas, it will appear dark brown. If you take it from the rural areas, it looks like water. It's obvious that a lot of materials that don't dissolve in water end up there, and materials that fall out of the air end up there. The microlayer is an active area of research and basically considered kind of the next generation of active pollution control, how you can protect, how one can protect that microlayer. Boats and marinas, both from discharge of oil and other materials overboard from recreational boaters, as well as bottom paints on boats. Many of you may know, if you're boaters, that tributyl tin, which is a very popular bottom paint in the early 1980s, has been banned, first by the state of Washington and now by the federal government, on small boats that are not aluminum, because tributyl tin is very, very toxic to invertebrate species, particularly oysters, clams, and mussels, and is likewise toxic to little critters, such as juvenile salmon. The bottom paints from boats tend to slough off in pretty high levels in marinas. This happens to be a marina where we've taken some samples and have found tributyl tin levels in the bottom sediments that are way above the level that are lethal to invertebrates. And needless to say, there weren't any barnacles on the bottoms of those boats. Also, commercial boating. Trash dumped overboard is decreasing on the Sound, but there are still incidents of it. And the ferries play a fairly significant role. The sewage from ferries was discharged into the Sound until about 5 years ago. That practice has been completely ceased. But the ferry yards, the vicinity around the ferry yards, happens to be a very heavily contaminated area, particularly in the bottom sediments. Suburbanization. I'm not picking on that Dairy Queen, They just happened to build there, and this lawn out front happens to be in front of another restaurant, which had been there quite a bit longer. And this restaurant was basically a victim of suburbanization. They'd had a drain field out here and a septic tank system, and you can see that a whole bunch of portholes had been put in their drain field because of the fact that the drain field no longer worked. And among other things, they had high levels of oil and grease, as many restaurants do, that they now pump out through these various portholes. The restaurant had been there about 15 years before suburbanization had really occurred at that intersection. And after the area got built up was when they really started having their problems. Of course, it could be that their drain field was just taking that long to plug up, like the one here at Holden Village. Oil spills. This is the Port Angeles oil spill, the Arco Anchorage in 1985, December 23rd, 1985. The guy standing over there was wearing a yellow rubber suit, but all you can tell is yellow are his suspenders. This is oil up here. Plastic debris. Puget Sound has a very active Adopt-a-Beach program, and fortunately our debris is dropping. And increasing population. The Puget Sound region today is right about 3 million. It's estimated by the year 2000 it'll be at 3.6 million, and by the year 2010 about 4 million. Actually, you could probably speak to that even better. We have a transportation planner sitting in the audience who is also equally concerned about population growth. But all these issues that I've just very, very quickly covered are all made worse by population growth. That was just a quick run through of some of the issues that are affecting Puget Sound, and all of them, each one of them, we could have a couple hours discussion on, and hopefully we can come back to them. But I want to move on to talk about some of the things that are indeed happening. Puget Sound has about 140 or so different jurisdictions, from local governments, tribal governments, regional organizations, county governments, as well as the state, and of course the federal government. Because of all these different jurisdictions, many of which have overlapping responsibilities and authorities, the Puget Sound Water Quality Authority was created in 1985 to prepare a Puget Sound plan. The first Puget Sound Management Plan was prepared in 1987, and this happens to be the latest one, the 1991 Puget Sound Management Plan, with a rather distinctive purple color cover. You can get one by dialing 1-800-54-SOUND if you want one. But that plan was responsible for a process of figuring out what to do to clean up, preserve, and protect Puget Sound. At about the same time in 1986, the Washington State Legislature passed an 8-cent a pack tax on cigarettes, and that cigarette tax was directed specifically toward water quality issues. You might ask how they're linked. The tobacco industry did too when the bill passed, but it passed anyway. You never have to worry about the Washington State Legislature using logic in developing these pieces of legislation. They found a good source of money. Brought in about $45 million a year, $90 million a biennium, but unfortunately revenues have started to drop because fewer people in Washington State are smoking today. So if you know any out-of-state smokers, and they're smoking anyway, have them buy cigarettes while they're here. The legislature the state government makes up monies out of the general fund to bring it up to the $45 million. Half of the $45 million is directed toward Puget Sound. The other half of the $45 million is directed toward the rest of the state and water quality issues in the rest of the state, of which, of course, there's a lot with many of their own issues. Half of the fund is directed toward capital construction. Half is directed toward other proactive activities. By capital construction, I mainly mean construction of wastewater treatment plants And in the Puget Sound region, most of that money is going to Metro, which covers much of King County and treats King County's waste before it's discharged into Puget Sound. Metro is building a very large new wastewater treatment plant with secondary treatment at West Point.
Is West Point the same as Discovery Park?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Right. It's being built on the edge of Discovery Park, right out in the waterfront. The cigarette tax and the creation of the Puget Sound Water Quality Authority has played a major role, or at least I like to think, in shaping the planning for Puget Sound. But we have a lot of other overlapping jurisdictions. And one of those includes the Federal Superfund Project. And those of you who were here yesterday heard me mention the fact that Superfund plays a significant role within Tacoma. Tacoma was designated as the first underwater Superfund site in the country in 1981. In my opinion, the inner waterway in Seattle isn't as bad a shape, but the people who made the decision were choosing one place or another, and they lived in Seattle, so they chose Tacoma. In some ways, it's brought us more money in Tacoma, where I live. In other ways, it's brought us a lot more notoriety. But at any rate, Tacoma is a Superfund site. It has several sites, but particularly what I'm going to focus on is the area off the Asarco smelter and the urban waterways of which you saw that overhead shot earlier on. And this is the Puyallup River. So Superfund has been in Tacoma for quite a while and has done some pretty extensive studies. I think that probably Tacoma, the Commencement Bay Superfund site, is the most studied site in the country. Boston Harbor comes close, but I think Tacoma beats Boston Harbor out in terms of studies. Part of the reasons for these studies were diseased fish, and particularly fish with liver tumors. These are English sole livers. This is a healthy liver. This is a liver with tumors. You can't always tell whether a tumor is malignant or benign, but histopathologists tell me that liver has plenty of benign nodules, plenty of malignant nodules in it. When Commencement Bay was found in one waterway to have 8 to 10% tumors in the fish, it was considered pretty scandalous. That was in about 1979. In the mid-1980s, an area called Eagle Harbor on Bainbridge Island was found to have, the bottom fish were found to have tumors. About 25% of the bottom fish had tumors. About 100% of the fish had either tumors or pre-tumor conditions. At any rate, the English sole catch rate has gone down in the Sound, both because of the liver tumors, but probably even more significantly because of reproductive failures among the female fish in terms of egg maturation. English sole live in and on the bottom sediments. Well, Commencement Bay, as I say, was studied pretty thoroughly, and there was a direct link made between chemicals in the bottom sediments and tumors in the fish, decreased number of species that lived in and around the bottom sediments, and the toxicity of those sediments. Some of the components that were significant included polychlorinated biphenyls, which were used in electrical insulators, now banned but still fairly widely distributed in the environment. PAHs, or polyaromatic hydrocarbons, which come from partially burned fuels. And of course, the most notable PAH is benzoylpyrene, which is in cigarette smoke and on overgrilled steaks. Metals came from metal smelting, urban and storm runoff, etc. And a couple of sets of chemicals that came directly from manufacturing practices. Methylphenol from pulp mills and chlorinated organics that largely came from facilities that at one point in time had manufactured pesticides. Fortunately, Puget Sound wasn't contaminated all over, nor was Commencement Bay. The middle of Commencement Bay is deep. It's about 450 feet deep. The waterways are shallow. When it came, for instance, to the methylphenol and chlorinated organics, you could pick out specific areas that were real hot spots. Likewise, PCBs and PAHs and metals. So agencies were able to say, okay, these are the areas that are highest priority. And you can see there are a total of 7 areas. They've actually divided them into 9 different segments that are the highest priority for cleanup. Well, why clean them up? Why worry about them? Well, as I've already mentioned, you have toxic sediments and unhealthy critters that live in the toxic sediments. And the Puyallup tribe is very concerned about fisheries, as are all the tribes in Puget Sound. In terms of the cleanup, it was a two-pronged approach. First thing you want to do is stop the sources. If you're still putting stuff into the water that end up in the bottom sediments, you're never going to clean it up. So stopping the sources and reducing the discharges is the first phase, followed by some kind of cleanup later on. I won't go into all the details of the cleanup, but let's just say that there are lots of possible actions that range from very cheap, with no action, but very high risk to the environment and potentially to human health, to taking the material out by dredging it, then incinerating it, then glassifying it, and then putting it in a disposal landfill, which of course would be very, very, very expensive. General alternatives include capping it with green material, perhaps in place, and on Thursday I'm going to talk a little bit about a successful project that's done exactly that. Or digging it up and taking it to shore where it's then capped and contained, or digging it up and taking it to a very near shore area where it might well be capped and contained. These kinds of decisions are just being made at Superfund sites in Tacoma, Seattle, Bainbridge Island, Everett, as well as elsewhere around the country. These are the kinds of issues that go into determining a cleanup, giving us some areas that we do indeed think are probably clean. And one of them happens to be just off of this paper plant in Tacoma. It's an area right out here of 17 acres that's now considered to be relatively well-restored intertidal habitat. That was an example of a fairly complex and tedious process that's already gone on for 10 years. Sometimes the actions are a little bit more dramatic. This happens to be General Metals in Tacoma. They were under order to buy pollution control equipment, and they bought it, but they never bothered to install it. So they have been criminally prosecuted. So far they've only been fined. Nobody was sent to jail. There have been other cases where various officials of companies have had their hands slapped pretty hard. Wyckoff Chemical Company in Seattle was fined $1 million. These were all examples of criminal action which were pretty blatant. As I mentioned before, capital construction is another way to clean up pollution, and wastewater treatment plants are either under construction, such as in the case of West Point, the Metro plant in Seattle, which will eliminate the largest primary plant that exists in the Puget Sound region and turn it into a secondary plant. Right now it's called Advanced Primary, but it discharges a peak flow during rainfall of up to 650 million gallons a day, although the average discharge is much, much smaller than that, at somewhere around 150 million gallons a day. Tacoma has just built a secondary treatment plant which is operating well. Sometimes we use short-term solutions. This happens to be a restaurant, next to a restaurant, on the banks of Puget Sound, where the restaurant had no alternative because of its very serious problems, but to install a tank that gets pumped. And that restaurant was particularly significant because it's located within 100 yards of an oyster bed. Unfortunately, the oyster bed has been decertified for other reasons. This is an excellent example of another project that's worked. Here's a stream, and this bank right here was once totally barren because a guy had about 100 head of cattle on a lot that was much too small. They were not fenced off from the stream, and they were in the stream constantly because it was their primary source of drinking water. Today, they've worked with the farmer. He has gotten rid of most of his cattle. It was a pretty uneconomic process anyway. And the stream bank is pretty much revegetated, and there are now steelhead coming up this stream again to spawn. Other solutions can involve individuals as well. This is an example of new construction of a house in Seattle on a lot that was very marginal for a septic system. And instead, they worked and put in a mound system, which is pumped and is actually working quite well as an alternative to a septic system that could well fail. They were in an area where they couldn't hook up to a wastewater treatment plant very easily. Back to my grandfather's pesticides, they were taken to a household hazardous waste pickup day in Pierce County, and there are pickup days going on all over the Puget Sound region right now, and I know a lot of the rest of the country is developing them as well. And in Thurston County, at the Thurston County landfill, they have a little building they call the Hazo House, where you can drop off your hazardous materials. Construction practices have improved a lot as well. This is an example of a grassy swale that was under construction, where grasses were to be planted in this ditch to control runoff from the nearby freeway before that runoff impacted the stream that runs down through the trees here. In addition, if you look around this construction site, there's essentially a specific black plastic membrane designed to catch the silt so it won't get washed down into the river, the stream, while construction is underway. This happens to be a sign that talks about some of the non-point pollution controls that are going on at a test project where they'd had serious problems in another stream and have basically controlled those problems through individual practices by individual people. For those of you who saw the video yesterday, I said the laws are on the books. The laws are on the books, but the laws aren't always easy to implement. The Washington State Department of Ecology is typical of many state environmental departments around the country. From 1985 till today, it's grown from about 500 employees to about 1,550 employees. That's why there are a lot of jobs available in the environmental community right now, either as a regulator or another position. Well, that was a quick run through of some of the issues related to Puget Sound and a few of the solutions that have worked. It's taken us a long time to pollute Puget Sound. European Americans have been here for about 140 years, as I said at the beginning. It's going to take us a long time to begin to reverse that pollution and begin to turn things around in the sound. I'd say that the three greatest challenges facing Puget Sound are the reduction of sources, inputs into the sound, potential cleanup of toxic materials, of severely contaminated areas in the bottom of the sound, control of bacterial and viral contamination that restricts the use of shellfish, and that we need to stop and reverse the declines in the various kinds of habitat and our loss of fish stocks, of which I've just shown you one example here. This past January, 800 people showed up at a meeting in Seattle called the Puget Sound Research Conference, and they were people who came from all over the country. It was obvious from that meeting that there are a lot of people concerned about Puget Sound, but in addition, a lot of people were concerned, were interested in coming because they saw some things happening here that could well serve to be models for elsewhere in the country. With the exception of Chesapeake Bay, Puget Sound is probably the most studied estuary in the country, And it's been featured in the Estuary of the Month Club that NOAA has, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It was designated as an estuary of national significance about 3 years ago. And the Puget Sound Water Quality Management Plan was the first plan accepted by the Environmental Protection Agency and the federal government as a comprehensive management plan for an estuary. And that was through under the Clean Water Act. One of the things that the Puget Sound Management Plan does, I don't mean to sell this too hard, but it tries to take a holistic approach to the problems of the sound, recognizing that the problems are not just industry, that they're not just wastewater treatment plant, and they're not just you and I, but rather they're all segments of the population. For those of you who will be around on Thursday, I'm going to talk about a couple of restoration projects that have gone on in the sound, and I'm going to talk a little bit about fish stocks in the sound. You might also want to catch Jill Whitman's presentation on Thursday, because she's going to be talking about some of the water quantity issues, or how are we going to have enough water for the future period. Well, with that, I'd love to have some discussion, some questions, some bricks thrown at me. Yes?
I was stuck back there on the picture of the little place in the home that you said was restored. Is it restored so that things actually grew there again?
Yeah.
Oh.
It's really exciting. That area is directly off of the Simpson-Tacoma Craft plant from about 1927-28 until 1987. The discharge from that plant basically came out right at the tide level. High tide is underwater, low tide it ran across the bay. And an area off that plant was very substantially contaminated. It was basically dead. Nothing grew there. There are two reasons why it was basically dead. One was chemical contamination, and the other was wood chips. And you saw all those wood chips sitting out there waiting to be made into paper. Well, a lot of them used to end up on the bottom. So the area was smothered. What they did, they were under orders to relocate that outfall into deeper water, and it's now relocated offshore about a quarter of a mile, has a long pipe that has slits in it for a diffuser, and is in water where it's diluted much more rapidly and theoretically at least carried out to sea. When they relocated that outfall, they knew they were going to have to do something with that area covered by toxics and wood chips in the long run. So Simpson was proactive in terms of scooping it all up, putting it in one place, covering it with 8 to 12 feet of clay of Puyallup River sediments, and then putting more Puyallup River sediments over the top to turn it into an area that was intertidal rather than a deep water area, dredged deep water area like it had been. That happened in 1987-88, and this year it was declared a success. Things have recolonized it. You can go out there and find mussels, you can find barnacles on the rock, you can find fucus or a whole bunch of different forms of algae. You can find crabs, you can find juvenile salmon in that area. They completely changed the way they handle their bark dust, their bark materials, and their wood chips. And so far, so good.
That's great.
Yeah.
So what about all that stuff going out into the deeper water? Isn't that kind of sleazy?
Well, every industry discharges. Every industry like that discharges into Puget Sound. That facility happens to discharge between about 32 and 40 million gallons a day. That is about half the volume of the Tacoma Central Wastewater Treatment Plant, which is very close by, which discharges is permitted to discharge about 78 million gallons a day. Both of them have what's called secondary wastewater treatment, which means that they bring the water to certain standards. Now, secondary means one thing when it comes to a municipal plant, and it means a slightly different thing when it comes to an industrial facility. But they both have fairly sophisticated wastewater treatment plants. The entire pulp and paper industry is under orders to improve the quality of their discharge pretty substantially. And that's been the subject of four general lawsuits that I can think of, and more numerous individual lawsuits, because the state last July issued permits to these plants that were very stringent permits. They immediately filed an appeal and immediately started filing some lawsuits as well. The Simpson plant is the one facility that has not, well, is involved in one lawsuit on dioxins, but it's not been involved in many of the other lawsuits because they decided that they want to continue to try and clean up, that it's good business. Some of the others are cleaning up, but they're what I would call using stall tactics, and also hoping to soften the degree of regulation a bit. And that's going to happen almost certainly. The new federal, the newspaper article this week that I just read here about the new federal policy on dioxins, which are a significant, one of the pollutants that's been considered a significant issue at pulp and paper plants. New federal policy is that they're going to make the regulation less stringent, and in doing so, it will mean that the pulp and paper plants probably will not have to meet the stringent requirements in the next 4 or 5 years. So that was a very long-winded answer to say that pulp and paper plants are significant dischargers to Puget Sound, but they're only part of the problem. Other questions? Comments?
I'm curious about the Eagle Harbor place, too, because I grew up right near there. Is that a dead harbor at this point?
Well, Eagle Harbor is not a healthy place. On one side of Eagle Harbor, which is on Bainbridge Island, let me just slap the map up here for those of you not from Puget Sound. One side of Eagle Harbor has the Wyckoff Chemical Company located on it, which makes wood treating agents, particularly creosote and pentachlorophenol, both designed to be toxic materials to keep stuff from growing on wood. Eagle Harbor is right in this little dent right here on Bainbridge Island. So on one side, the south side is Wyckoff, and then on the north side is the repair yard that's used by the ferries, as well as a couple of marinas. The ferries, the state of Washington and Wyckoff both point fingers at the other in terms of who's caused the problem. And Wyckoff, the Wyckoff company is a pretty tough company to deal with. The city of Seattle is where they were fined their $1 million, and that was partially because they were running garden hoses at night from their plant to nearby storm sewers and illegally discharging to the storm sewer that then went into the Duwamish. They, in the end, will probably clean up, but they won't do it easily. The wells to the south of the Wyckoff facility are private wells, and several of them are indeed contaminated with materials from the Wyckoff plant. So the bottom line is, Wyckoff, the Eagle Harbor is a mess.
I've often wondered about that harbor. It's a very long, windy thing that goes way back into the island, and it's completely mudflat during low tide.
Well, most of the toxicants are off the Wyckoff facility and off the ferry repair yard.
So
not so much back in the mud flats. Back in the mud flats, there's a higher level of bacterial contamination because, of course, there are a lot of septic systems around that part of Eagle Harbor, but there are no commercial shellfish beds or anything like that back there. And I don't know if anybody digs shellfish back there today. Yeah?
What is the ferry system now doing with its sewage?
I believe it stores it in holding tanks and offloads it at Fauntleroy or in Seattle.
Uh-huh.
I believe all of it goes into Metro.
So they've cleaned up.
Yeah.
I wondered if that was also something that was happening at Eagle Harbor.
Historically, probably yes.
Yeah.
But not anymore. Yeah.
Could you please compare or talk a little bit about the canal area?
Oh, sure. This is Hood Canal. For those of you not from the Pacific Northwest, when you say the word canal, you might think of something that was made by humans. It was definitely not. Hood Canal is a perfect example of a fjord, as I should have mentioned earlier on, as is all of Puget Sound. Outside of the state of Alaska, this is the only fjord in the U.S. Hood Canal has some problems, many of them involving contamination by seals. There are a couple of state parks along here that have actually had their shellfish beds closed because of bacterial contamination. Initially, there were, and these are recreational shellfish beds, not shellfish beds commercially harvested. Initially, people thought that it was failing septic systems in the area, and maybe that the parks weren't doing a very good job of treating their waste. But since then, it's been pretty much demonstrated the problem is because of the high seal population in the area. Now, there's a lot of debate over whether fecal material from seals is necessarily going to be anything that harms humans. The flip side of it is fecal coliform counts, the bacteria that commonly occur in human waste, when that waste comes from humans, are generally a good measure of possible pathogens, bacteria and viruses. Well, right now there's no easy way to separate fecals from seals from fecals from humans, so you don't know exactly why these shellfish are contaminated, and the health department has basically decided to err on the side of protection by saying that the shellfish beds are closed. I don't mean air, they've decided to be conservative and say that the shellfish beds are closed. When you get down to the lower end of Hood Canal, it's another story. Anybody who's driven along the road right along here knows that the houses are just basically one on top of each other. Along that area, the bacterial contamination comes from septic tanks that aren't working right or didn't exist, and the Alderbrook Resort. The Alderbrook Resort is a real nightmare story on its own. It was built with a wastewater treatment plant that should have been just fine. But for a couple of years, they didn't have anybody to run it. Mm-hmm. And it was basically in the failure mode for that whole period of time. The neighbors kept getting more and more and more and more concerned, but had a very hard time getting anybody's attention. It's only been in the last 5 or 6 months that they've really gotten people's attention with the continuing ongoing problem. It was quite ironic when the Department of Ecology held a retreat at the Alderbrook Inn and then realized that the inn had pretty serious problems. They weren't aware of it when they went there. But anyway, it's now, it's been pumping its septic, pumping its waste and hauling it to another plant. It's now got its facility supposedly back up and operating, I guess. Those are the biggest problems. There's some other significant issues. The Bangor base, which is right about here, is a submarine base. It was designed in the 1970s. And the base itself is pretty environmentally sound in terms of its wastewater treatment, how it handles its submarines, how it handles its paints, because it does a lot of submarine repair there, etc. But it was built at the site of an old munitions factory. That munitions factory made munitions for World War II when they weren't quite so careful with how they handled their TNT wastes, etc. And because of that, the groundwater around on the Bangor site is pretty contaminated, and there's some actual locations within the base that are very heavily contaminated. It's a Superfund site under the reauthorization of Superfund in 1986. Likewise, Indian Island, which is further up here somewhere, was another site where munitions had been handled, and it's also not considered to be a very good, it's considered to be a real mess. Those are the main issues on Hood Canal. Failing septic tanks, oh, the one other one I ought to mention is on this side of the canal there's some pretty poor logging practices that still continue and tend to put a lot of sediment down into some of the rivers. But those are the main issues, failing septic tanks, bacterial contamination, and a few toxic sites. Hood Canal is considered the most pristine part of Puget Sound, period, today. Yes?
Do you get involved in logging practices and have any pressure on the logging industry?
There's an agreement in the state of Washington called TFW, Timber, Fish, and Wildlife, which brought together the logging industry, the state, environmental groups, and the tribes to figure out ways to do logging practices better to help stop some of the problems. That TFW agreement was implemented in 1988 and is now just really getting rolling. Unfortunately, like everything else, there's not as much funding as would be nice to actually get people out in the field to monitor logging practices. Some of the biggest problems in terms of logging practices that are going on right now are up in Snohomish County, where Burlington Northern has, and other logging companies, Plum Creek is a subsidiary of Burlington Northern, have sold a lot of their holdings to Taiwanese and Korean outfits who are basically coming in and cutting all the trees. You know, it's cut and run logging. And it's pretty blatant in Snohomish County right now. And actually, Trillium was proposing to log a big hunk of Whitby, and some of that happened and a lot of it's been stopped. But it's foreign logging operations that are causing the biggest problems right now, the really scary logging problems.
Do we have control of that, or we cannot?
The Washington Forest Practices Act has control over that, but what do you do in hindsight?
Wow.
You know, when it's cut and run practices, and they have to get a permit to log. They get their permit, but if you don't have the people to go out there and inspect them while they're logging, it's too late. People are on to Trillium and some of the other companies now, and they're watching them pretty closely, but in the meanwhile, they did a lot of damage. And there'll be some big clear cuts still to come. Yeah?
Plum Creek has a pretty serious problem.
Oh, yeah, but they've turned over a new leaf. They're good guys now.
You're sure good.
No, compared to the Taiwanese companies, Plum Creek is looking pretty good.
Really? Yeah.
Is Plum Creek an American? Yeah. Well, Burlington Northern was one big conglomerate, and it's split in half. And the details of the split are complicated, but the logging company, the logging and sawmill company, Plum Creek, ended up with one half of it. And actually, that half has more progressive management than when it was together in Burlington Northern. Yeah. Okay, time for us to wind up. Thank you very much.